Hey, welcome along. This is a brand new format for our Clubland Q&As, taking questions from Markstein Club members all around the planet on whatever you want for the next hour. And we have various parts of the world to get to. I've got some problem with feedback here. Don't worry, we'll sort that out. I'm hearing myself in echo chamber. We've got some. Is that? Oh no, that's not working. Is that okay? That's gone. That was a great start. Super professional. We can't go anywhere but up from that. Anyway, it's like Tuesday lunchtime on the west coast of the Americas. It's Tuesday afternoon on the east coast. It's Tuesday evening in Britain, Europe, the Middle East, and Wednesday morning in Asia and the Pacific, and wherever you are. Do please feel free via the comments form at steinonline.com to shoot me a question on whatever's on your mind. Let's get to it. The first one comes from David Fiorito. Mark, love the new format. Question, well, you probably don't after that beginning. Question, what do you think President Trump should do now about the Norks? We seem to be painted into a corner. Ignore them? Send in SEAL Team 6? David poses an interesting question. North Korea, I've made jokes about North Korea's ICBMs for as long as they've been firing them off, because, as I always say, the intercontinental ballistic missile of North Korea, it's the intercontinental bit they seem to be having the difficulty with. They basically loose these things, it clears the perimeter fence and comes down in the Taco Bell parking lot just across the street from the base. If they have Taco Bell in North Korea, I'm generalizing here. And they're so pathetic. I actually make a joke about the ineffectiveness of North Korean nukes in the final verse of my version of The Cat Came Back on my Feline Groovy album. Normally I like to keep the music a little separate from the politics. We got a little bit of a touch of the old politics with Kim Jong-un making a rare appearance on a musical project at the end of my version of The Cat Came Back on Feline Groovy. But this nuke, this missile he launched the other day, this ICBM, actually went 45 minutes. It flew 45 minutes before it came down in the Sea of Japan. So it may well be that Kim has the ability to reach the west coast of the United States. There was talk about this 15 year or two before 9/11, I would say, when there was talk that they were gonna his father was going to nuke Montreal, because he'd calculated that nuking a Canadian city would show that they were serious, the North Koreans were serious, but without attracting overwhelming force back from the United States. And what I worry about, David, is that we are in a situation where the Norks are going to actually have to use one of these nukes before they do anything about it. Deterrence is obviously ineffective with the North Koreans because they're not deterred. They're an economic basket case, but the entry to the nuclear club, threshold for entry is very low, and they have done nothing to indicate that they're in any other mood other than to rush on and achieve real nuclear capacity. So they've indicated they're not interested in deterrence. They can't be deterred. Then you get to the other factor. When a country has a small number of nukes, it has an incentive to use them and use them fast. It's not like the United States and Russia, where both parties have got bazillions of nukes. So once they get into a nuclear conflagration, there's an interest in de-escalating, because each participant has got so many bazillions of weapons that it can go on forever until everything's destroyed. If you've got a small number of nukes, as North Korea will have, then it's in your interest to use them very quickly. And I worry that given the difficulties of actually taking care of this situation before they use them, we may well be in a situation of waiting until they do use them. This is a tragedy. The original five nuclear powers were the five members of permanent members of the Security Council, the World War II victors parade, in effect, the United States, United Kingdom, France, Soviet Union, and China. It was a tightly held group. And the left, as you recall, were kind of crazy about it. They wrote plays, they made films about impending nuclear Armageddon. Now we have a situation where some of the poorest countries on the planet are nuclearizing, and we're doing nothing about it. And I think the situation we're in vis-a-vis North Korea is that it will be very difficult to rouse ourselves to action until they use one of these things. I think we're moving into a world more generally beyond deterrence. I think of Osama bin Laden and Mullah Omar sitting in some cave in Afghanistan on September the 10th, 2001. And they are about to go ahead and rip the tallest buildings out of the heart of Lower Manhattan and hit the Pentagon and either the White House or the Capitol, wherever Flight 93 was headed for. And in theory, the United States has the capacity to simply turn Afghanistan into a giant crater. And if either Mullah Omar or Osama bin Laden knew about that, thought about that, they evidently didn't care about it. And in a sense, they were right not to, because instead we've just been ineffectually running around Afghanistan for the last 16 years. So we are in a world beyond deterrence. Our enemies know that, and our enemies behave accordingly. And that is the world that we are moving into. I did say you could write about anything. This is an odd one for me. T.F. Boggs writes, Mark, is there any weirder jazz single to become a hit than Candyman, performed by Sammy Davis Jr. from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory? This was a big hit in the early 70s, Candyman, by my old friends Anthony Newley and Leslie Brickus. And I had a long conversation with Leslie Brickus about this because it was a number one record. And the whole reason it was assumed to get to number one, if you were a teenager and in the schoolyard back then, you know that Candyman was supposed to be about drugs, you know. Who can take a sunbeam? And the whole thing was that it was supposed to be about drugs. And the Candyman was your drug supplier. And Leslie and Tony Newley assured me that that was the farthest thing from their mind. They wrote the song, The Candyman, because it was in the film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And the only concession they made to the American hit parade was they didn't call it the Sweet Shop Man, which would have been the British English version. So they thought they'd Americanize it and call it The Candyman. And instead, every aberrant, dysfunctional, juvenile, delinquent teenager thought it was a drug song and so made that Sammy Davis record number one. And good for them. Mark, do you think that General Kelly will be able to rein in President Trump on Twitter, writes Laura Rosen-Cohen. Is it necessary or is Twitter sacrosanct for President Trump? Yeah, I think Twitter is the fireside chat. What fireside chats were to FDR, I think Twitter is to Trump. And Trump is not going to let his enemies shut him down on Twitter. And the fact is that for whatever reason, that works. People report his tweets live. If you look at morning show television in the United States, he gets up at 5 a.m. and he does his first couple of tweets of the day. And then they spend hours talking about it on all the morning TV shows. He's not going to give that up. He's actually plugged into. I'm not a big Twitter fan, by the way. Twitter has now lost money for, I think it's 15 straight quarters or something. Nobody has figured out a way. People are leaving Twitter. Nobody can figure out how to make money on Twitter compared to Facebook. It's far less profitable. But the one thing it works for, I think, is that journalists and wannabe journalists, so the media are playing on Twitter all the time. This is another reason why newspapers are going out of business, because they got all these layabout deadbeat staff reporters who are actually not out doing any reporting. They're just monkeying around on Twitter all day long, responding to the provocations of President Trump. He's in their head. That's as near as he can be as actually performing the Candyman and selling them some Trump drug. The Trump Twitter feed is the Candyman of the second decade of the 21st century. And he's not going to give that up. Ian writes, could you give us an update on Stein versus Mann? What will you do with the $5 million payout? Well, the $5 million payout, I'm ruined! Because, like, the legal bills are $9 million. So if we just get a $5 million, it's the old... It's the old line. Mel Brooks's mother said to him after she saw a print of Blazing Saddles. She goes, Melvin, it's a marvel. It should only make $1 million. And he said to her, if it does, we're screwed. It costs $3 million. And that's the same with this case. If we only get a $5 million payout, the Stein versus Mann, Mann versus Stein, I can't remember which way it is now. It's Mann versus Stein. And then I countersued, which is Stein versus Mann. But if we only get a $5 million payout, that's not going to go anywhere. That's a joke. It'd be humiliating. Be humiliating only that. Where we are is that it's been procedurally wrecked by a totally incompetent DC judge. And as a result, there is an interlocutory appeal. And I could tell you what an interlocutory appeal would be, but it makes my eyeballs bleed. And it should make your eyeballs bleed. Because if you're interested in what an interlocutory appeal is, you need to get out of the house more. Interlocutors used to be something in 19th century minstrel shows. They were the ones who I can't get into that because now I'm committing a race crime talking about 19th century minstrel shows. But I'd rather have an interlocutor from a 19th century minstrel show than an interlocutory appeal at the DC Court of Appeals. For one thing, it's over a lot quicker. The DC Court of Appeals, there was an interlocutory appeal to it, and the one judge there, she has a relaxed approach to her job, and as a result, it took them 3 years to issue their ruling on this interlocutory appeal, after which a couple of the parties then went back to ask for an en banc appeal. And if you don't know what an interlocutory appeal is, you don't want to know what an en banc appeal is, because what that means is it's the whole bench. So that's not just the three judges who won this last interlocutory appeal, but all seven judges, all nine judges, all 17 judges, however many they got on that thing. So there's going to be an en banc appeal. And that always reminds me of the Sun in Fleet Street, their old famous bumper sticker, honk if you bonk. And I might get one made up called honk if you're on bonk at the DC Court of Appeals. And they'll issue a ruling on that in 3 to 5, 7, 12 years. And if I'm still alive, then that will be going to the Supreme Court of the United States. So that's where we are. What is at issue in this case when you take out all the interlocutory, oh, my darling little mammy down in Alabama, all the interlocutory minstrel stuff? What is left out of this is the fact that nowhere in the common law world, until these judges, has anybody even entertained the notion that courtrooms should adjudicate science, that science should be adjudicated by jurors. And if that happens, that's bad not just for science, but it's bad for public policy in general. Basically, Michael Mann is asking a jury to put his hockey stick, his disreputable hockey stick, which is been demolished by and is reviled by hundreds of scientists around the world, and even more tellingly, those who decline to express a view on it, nevertheless decline to defend it also. And that hockey stick, that climate change hockey stick, if Michael Mann were to reach the point where judges agree that jurors should rule on whether his hockey stick can be placed beyond criticism, we will be entering a whole new realm. This case should have been dismissed in a functioning jurisdiction, which the District of Columbia isn't. In a functioning jurisdiction, this case would have been dismissed within 6 weeks. Mike writes, Re-Europe's deathbed demography and childless leaders. I agree with your analysis in large part, but Poland's birth rate seems to contradict some of the logic as to the cause of dropping European fertility rates. Poland is a religious country, at least by European standards. It is fairly heterogeneous in terms of ethnicity and religion, much like Ireland. Poland has also been on the receiving end of the last century's injustices, invaded by Germany, ruled by the Soviets, etc. Therefore, Poland is without the guilt causing the ethno-masochism in Germany et al. All of these are evidenced by its display of cultural confidence and its refusal to admit refugees as demanded by EU leaders. Yet despite being more religious and comfortable with themselves, and despite having a relatively low cost of living, Poland has one of the lowest fertility rates in the EU, 1.3 children per woman. Why? By the way, when Sebastian Kurz becomes Austria's new prime minister in a few weeks' time, add one more to the childless PM list, although he's young and will probably make a good one. Yeah, that's a very good point, Mike. Everyone looks to the division between Western Europe, which is riddled with first world guilt, post-colonial guilt, imperialism guilt, and that's why its birth rate has collapsed and all the rest. That's a big part of what Douglas Murray talks about when he appeared on the Mark Steyn show a few weeks ago. And people often talk about Eastern Europe as the antidote to that. But you are correct to point out that Poland actually has as bad a fertility rate as Western Europe. And by the way, 1.3 is what demographers call lowest low fertility, the point at which you cannot recover. Throughout human history, it might be that, you know, they create Austin Powers fembots for the Poles and everybody's all very happy with them, with the sex bots, and they get it on with them and a whole new generation of Poles are. We don't know. But throughout human history, no society has recovered from a fertility rate of 1.3 children per couple. And I would distinguish it this way. And in fact, this is backed up by the UN survey from a few years ago. Western Europe has population growth because it's invited a vast Muslim population to be the children they couldn't be bothered having themselves. Eastern Europe has equally collapsed fertility rates and is basically emptying out. So that the population will fall. And the further east you go, the more dramatically it will fall. Now, in Russia, once you get to Russia, they've got real problems there because the percentage of their babies that they abort is extraordinary. And I think this, you say they haven't been saddled with any of the post-colonial guilt and all the stuff that afflicts Western Europe, but they have another kind of guilt. Or they have another kind of problem, to be fair. And that is that communism made those people conclude that life was not worth it. And so there was no point giving birth to new life. Because why would you have children to raise them in a miserable, stinking hellhole of a communist country? So if you look at everything that's happened in the century since the Tsars were overthrown, the fertility rate, particularly after the Second World War, just boomf down into the dumpster of history. So those countries are beginning to see a big emptying out. And you can see that, for example, in Germany, because West Germany and East Germany were reunified in the 90s. And West Germany obviously was part of the free world, and they had a big Turkish Muslim population. And so Muslims are becoming the majority in all big German cities. Meanwhile, in East Germany, on the East German plain, you see villages that are actually emptying out. There's not enough people to support the infrastructure. There's a very poignant image of that in my book America Alone, which is that sewer systems in East German villages are having to be reconfigured because there's not enough flow in them to keep the pipes moving. In other words, a sewer system requires a certain number of flushes to keep that stuff all going down the pipes and in, out in to the municipal septic tank or whatever they have. And there aren't enough people left in these villages to keep the sewage flowing in these pipes, which is a very poignant image because it means that even flushing yourself down the toilet of history is harder than it looks. And that is the situation that a lot of those East German villages are in. have you heard, Yvonne Cunningham says, have you heard about Jordan Peterson's Google account being suspended? What if all your videos were not available on YouTube? The social media sites are moving into censorship now. Distressing but predictable in our current atmosphere of hysteria. Yes, it's very interesting. Jordan Peterson, who was on the Mark Steyn show a few months ago, and very popular. There's over 200,000 people have seen that video on YouTube, which doesn't sound like a lot of people. But for example, it's as many as Ashley Banfield gets at primetime, 8 p.m. Eastern on CNN's Headline News channel. So it's, you know, it's respectable. And Jordan Peterson is a very compelling speaker. He has a very popular YouTube channel. And for some reason, it has been taken down. And he can't get access to it. And as always with YouTube, he can't get anyone at YouTube to actually explain to him why his channel has been shut down. This has just happened. And I can only tell you this, because YouTube is basically institutionalized copyright theft for the most part. And any time I've ever had any dealings with YouTube, is it extremely difficult to get anybody there to respond to anything. And that's how they've become one of the biggest companies in the world, basically. They, you know, some guy makes a pop video in 1983 and somebody posts it on YouTube and the guy sees it and complains about it. And in the 6 weeks it takes YouTube to do anything about it, it's been seen by a gazillion people and YouTube has made a ton of money. That's their basically their business model. Now, I would say, I would make the bigger point. People say about Jordan Peterson being banned on YouTube, well, YouTube is a private company. It has the right to ban anyone it wants. And that's true at a certain level. And I would then, so I would then extrapolate from that. I found the internet far more fun before they invented social media. I think the dominance of these cartels, YouTube, Facebook and Twitter has made the internet a lot more boring than it was 15 years ago. And I think ultimately it is going to make the internet a lot less free. If you look at it from government's point of view, from whether you're talking about the United States or the European Union, whoever you want, the European Union would rather deal with three companies that are as big as sovereign states, which is to say Facebook, YouTube and Twitter, then have bazillions of little unregulated, no-name blog sites and whatever to deal with, as they did 15 years ago. So it's in the direct interest of big government to have big social media. And my view, I mean, for example, if you're the Chinese Politburo, it's much easier to reach a deal with Google and YouTube and Facebook and Twitter than it is with a zillion different blog site owners. So my view is that this concentration of internet power in the hands of these social media companies is making the internet considerably less free. And that is sad. What can be done about it? Well, if you notice, it's the social justice warriors have no trouble getting people of a non-leftish disposition banned, as has happened just now with Jordan Peterson, because Jordan Peterson speaks out on free speech issues. So someone's complained about it at YouTube and YouTube has banned Jordan Peterson. But the solution is every Do you know, I can't tell you how boring this is. It's almost as boring as Facebook and boring as Twitter and boring as YouTube. Every 48 hours, I get some email in my inbox from somebody who's starting a new conservative news site. I don't think we need any more conservative news sites, conservative news aggregators. You know, they're always wanting to know whether they can use my videos or my columns or whatever, because they're starting the new conservative news site that's going to be the one-stop shop for all your conservative news needs. There's a thousand, or you get people like starting these ones that are behind, where they're putting it behind some paywall, and that's where you're going to be able to go to see all these things. It would be far better if all these people investing money in new conservative news aggregators and all the rest of it were instead to start a non-left-wing YouTube, a non-left-wing Facebook, a non-left-wing Twitter. These organizations, as when you see Angela Merkel cozying up to the Facebook guy Zuckerberg about how they're going to clamp down on free speech in Germany, it would be far better, instead of having another, you know, Patriot Eagle rightwingnews.com, if these people were instead to actually create a new non-left of center YouTube or Facebook. That would be far more useful. Let's have a look. We're answering your questions live. How do you know it's live? Because I'm doing time checks. It's 4:26 Eastern, US Eastern time. That's 1:26 on the Pacific coast of the Americas. And that's 9:26 in London. That's BST. Is that, what does that stand for? Bovine spongiform time? No, British summertime. We've just had an update. Congratulations, Jordan Peterson. He has been, his banned YouTube account has been liberated and is now back in his hands again. Ah, that's amazing. It's only 45 seconds since I finished talking about it, and already it's he's back in control of it. We get results here. Hamish writes, why does the left seem not to have a sense of humor, especially at any satire aimed in their direction? Do they see it as a dissent from the accepted narrative and therefore it must be shut down? Well, I have a whole section in my book, The Undocumented Mark Steyn, called Last Laughs, because I do believe that we are moving into a world without jokes. And if you look at it, the left prides itself that they're the ones who are edgy and transgressive and all the rest of it. And the right, we're the ones who are kind of uptight and humorless and take everything so seriously. And in fact, those roles have changed. Political correctness means that if you're on the left, you spend a lot of time not noticing things. So you can't really do observational comedy anymore. You can do observational comedy if there's nothing human in it. You could say, do a joke about, I suppose, about the barcode scanner at the supermarket, because that is a not a living, breathing person. But you can't do jokes about people, because the whole point about left-wing ideology is that you can't notice anything. And I'll give you an example about this. Amy Schumer, who I don't find in the least bit funny, your mileage may vary, but Amy Schumer did say one thing that got a mild titter out of me. She said, I used to date Hispanic men, but then I decided I preferred consensual sex. That's pretty funny. But, of course, the inevitable happened. And people said, well, that's outrageous. She's implying that. And what happened? Inevitably, she then issued a tweet totally forswearing this joke. She misspoke. Don't know how it happened. It was obviously some kind of typing error on the prompter. Don't know how it happened. Don't know, blah, blah, blah. And she backed off from that. And that goes all the way down the line. Doesn't matter whether it's gays. Doesn't matter whether it's Muslims. Doesn't matter whether it's preoperative transgenders. You can't say a thing about anything, which means you can only make jokes about old white Republican men. They're the only people you can make jokes about. And it's and so eventually you wind up with the situation that Stephen Colbert was in when he made a joke about Trump firing Jim Comey. And he said, Trump, you may have heard, Trump has just fired Jim Comey. And there were huge amounts of cheers, the FBI director, and a huge amount of cheers in the whatever it is, the late show audience. And he goes, wow, there must be a lot of Trump fans here tonight. And then he had to explain to them that the political attitude behind his Jim Comey joke was that Trump is being, you know, a big fascist control freak, police state authoritarian in firing the FBI director. And then, of course, once they had been told what the correct political attitude to the joke is, the audience realized it shouldn't have applauded the firing of Jim Comey and it should have booed. And so then he got and he finished his remarks. And at that point, and if you notice on these late night comedy shows now, there's actually less and less spontaneous laughter. And there's more and more applause. People a joke is evolving in what it means in our society. It's no longer something that's funny. It's no longer a thigh slapper. It's no longer that you clutch your belly. It's something you applaud because it has the right, approved, correct political attitude. So we are moving into a world beyond jokes. And the only thing that is now preventing us from that is what I always used to bet on, which is the natural good sense of the people. And if we're in a world beyond that, then I really don't know where we go to that. Allison writes, if we've lost the belief that civilization is worth suffering for, what brings us back from that? Real suffering? I think it's imperative we find a new world where the risk takers find liberty worth the risk. Any other ideas? Well, this is a very important point you make, Alison. One of the problems with the world we live in is that if you decide, as one of the people pushing the European Constitution did a few years back, that we're fighting to build a Europe where it will not be necessary to die for anything. And one can understand why someone would say that after the consequences of the two great world wars in Europe. But, as I responded to him, a society that has nothing to die for, in a certain sense, has nothing to live for either. And that is the problem which we see in Europe. We have a... what Tocqueville writes about in Democracy in America, we have a sort of world of trivialities where people kind of revolve about themselves, living in a hyper-present tense. In a sense, civilization is a stream. There's a kind of passage about this in After America. And it's a compact between the present and the past and the future. You can use different images for it. The iceberg is a good one, where 7/8 of it are below the surface. That is true of any healthy society. We are living on the surface, but 7/8 of our society is below the surface. It's there. It's assumed. It's part of it. It's Lincoln, on the other hand, called it the mystic cords of memory, that a society shares certain whether it's fully conscious of them or not, it shares certain mystic chords of memory that it hears. And that compact between the present and the past enables you to have a future. If you just skitter around on the surface of the present, you are unlikely to have a future. And it's interesting to me. I got a letter earlier today from a lady called Christine, who she was talking about the Alan Bloom book, The Closing of the American Mind. I've got a big essay up at Stein Online writing about it. And she said she'd read that book when it came out in the 1980s. And she couldn't actually... she couldn't actually follow what he was saying, because in a sense her education was so basic, not to put her down or anything, but in a sense she had been educated not to even grasp what it was that he was on about. And she said she was grateful for reading my essay, because I'd actually explained, as she saw it, Alan Bloom's music thesis rather more clearly than he had. And I was thinking about Christine's letter, and it occurred to me that that is a real problem with where we are today. That in a sense, even to know what you have lost presumes some knowledge of that loss. So that if you have never been raised, if you have never been educated to hear the music in Shakespeare or Haydn or the great civilizational thread that connects Greece and Rome to Magna Carta and the United States Constitution and so on. If you have never, if that, all that is a mystery to you because you were just doing Maya Angelou at high school, it's very difficult even to have a sense of loss. And I think anyone who's actually tried to explain to people why a lack of pride in your civilization is a bad thing is aware that they don't even get it. They don't understand what it is. And don't forget that lies have to live in a void of ignorance. So first you have to create the void. So, for example, to say that imperialism is responsible for slavery, that's rubbish. The greatest force in the abolition of slavery from the majority of the planet was an imperialist institution, the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy in the 19th century expunged slavery from almost every corner of the globe, except a few parts of Africa and the Arab world where they carry on to this day. But slavery was as normal a feature of life as the sun coming up in the morning and setting in the evening for the entirety of human history, until the Royal Navy decided it was going to drive a stake through it and eliminate slavery. So three cheers for imperialism. If it weren't for imperialism, slavery would still be going on throughout the planet. And nobody knows that. Nobody knows that. If you talk to Americans, they think slavery is something that American Southerners invented. I mean, the degree of cultural ignorance is extraordinary. And it is a great evil to teach people to be either hostile or antipathetic to their own civilization. No good can come of it, because in the end, they will not defend what they do not know. And that is the world we're in. Michael Seth writes, greetings, Mark. If Western governments maintain their refusal to combat radical Islam at home, do you see a violent confrontation twixt the common Westerner and the jihadis, or just more gradual atrophy resulting in eclipse? That's Mike in Rockaway, New Jersey. And gradual atrophy resulting in eclipse is a grim epitaph, but it takes a lot to force an alternative to that. The point to remember about what's happening For example, in Germany, it didn't even make the news. A nightclub got shot up at, I think it was Saturday night. Just a couple of people dead and a few more injured. Doesn't even really excite us anymore. The fact that that happens the day before that at the biggest supermarket chain in Germany, one guy died because there was some crazy with a machete going down the aisles. As I said, the biggest supermarket chain in Germany, it's the equivalent of like Price Chopper. In this case, Customer Chopper. That's what was going on in that aisle in Germany. One guy dead. It doesn't even make the... This is an imported problem. People now say, oh, we've just got to manage this. We've got to live with this. There's no choice. No, the ruling political class chose to import this problem. We have been living with fairly obvious consequences of this problem since at least the Salman Rushdie fatwa, when thousands of supposed British subjects took to the streets of English cities to call for the death of one of their compatriots in Sir Salman. And since then, governments have not changed one whit the immigration policies that created that situation. In fact, the most extraordinary statistic since 9/11 is that the reaction of the entire Western world to 9/11 was to double the rate of Muslim immigration. And so the question that Mike poses is, if governments refuse to do anything about what is happening, will the people take it into their own hands? And I've heard a very interesting versions of this thesis. Colonel Ralph Peters, who is a familiar face on Fox News, for example, he was addressing my thesis, and he said, "You don't need to worry about Europe because they're going to do what they did in the 1940s. They're just going to slaughter all these people. So you know, he's the optimist for that. I'm saying the glass is 15/16 empty, and he's saying no, the glass is 1/16 full, because these tough European hombres, when they get mad, they get very brutal and very bloody, and they'll turn to the strong man on a horse." And this is where demographics come in, because as you know, if you walk through any European city at night, all the young people are non-European. So the likelihood of a strong man on a horse, the problem with the strong man on a horse theory is that the little old wizened guy isn't strong enough to get onto the horse. That's the problem with arguing for some kind of brutal civil war in Europe. I do not think it's not going to be peaceful. It's not going to be pretty. And there will be, the longer it goes on without European governments addressing the root cause, the less attractive some of these options will become. Only unattractive options will be left. But I don't even think that actually full-scale, full-bloody civil war is actually going to be the way to bet on this. Patty Burke writes, "Any chance you would consider Zippity-Doo-Dah as Song of the Week down the road?" We have had a miserable day. It's been really super heavy topics today. And the antidote to super heavy topics is Zippity-Doo-Dah. If Patty, I don't know whether you ever take your kids ziplining. I do. You know that thing? It's like a bit of wire strung between two trees. They do. We got tons of trees in my part of northern New England. So people like to go ziplining high up in the White Mountains or in the Green Mountains of Vermont or whatever. And there's a place that I like to go with my kids in the White Mountains. And before you go off to go ziplining in the trees, they always play Zippity-Doo-Dah, zip. My oh my, what a wonderful day. And I think that is one of the great songs of all time. It is from Song of the South, which is a Disney movie that they don't show anymore because it has so-called stereotyping in it, so they won't show it on TV or whatever. But Zippity-Doo-Dah, Mr. Bluebird on my shoulder, It's the truth, it's actual, everything is satisfactual. That is the only song ever written with the word satisfactual in it. I don't care for the Rolling Stones, I can't get no satisfaction. I don't need no satisfaction when I can get satisfactual with zippity-doo-dah. So thank you for reminding that, Patty. And we may well do that for you as a Song of the Week. T.F. Boggs writes, where can I contribute to the Have Mark Interview Theodore Dalrymple Fund? The combination of a Dalrymple-Stein bleak outlook on the future of Western society would be enough to send us all running for the bar at the Mark Stein Show. Could you two finish with Ain't That a Kick in the Head as a duet? Anthony Daniels, who is Theodore Dalrymple, Tony wouldn't care for doing Ain't That a Kick in the Head. That's not his bag, man. Actually, you've missed an appearance that Theodore Dalrymple and Anthony Daniels and I did together. You would have loved this. It was 20 years ago, and it was moderated by Mrs. Thatcher, of all people. And it got a little heated, so that at one point, Mrs. Thatcher raised her arms and went, boys, boys, to me and Anthony as we were debating something. And it was that's, as far as I know, that's the only time we've ever no, that's true, we've been on panels together, but that is a great suggestion. He is one of Anthony Daniels has a lot of very shrewd insights. He worked as a prison doctor for many years, and one of his favorite insights is this. He would go along to prison and he would interview these ne'er-do-wells about what had gotten wrong with their lives. And he said, in all the years I was a prison doctor, he goes, I met hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. If you ask them where it had gone wrong, they say, well, I fell in with the wrong crowd. And he said, over the years, I met hundreds and hundreds of people who fell in with the wrong crowd, but I never met a member of the wrong crowd. And that's true. And that's the excuses we make. But we will try to get Anthony Daniels onto the show. He's fabulous. He's actually more bleakly pessimistic than I am, in a way, in part because he doesn't want to end the show with Ain't That a Kick in the Head. Denise O'Leary writes, why do women want to be Muslimas now that the world offers women so much by way of security with freedom? I can understand if you don't know either. And she's referring to a phenomenon that I touched on when Douglas Murray was on the show, that if you look at the rate of Muslim conversion in the Western world, which is significant, most of the men are guys who are petty thieves and who convert to Islam in prison because it's the coolest gang on the planet. But the overwhelming majority of conversion to Islam in the Western world is by women. Women. And it's quite extraordinary. And you can see there was a, I think she wrote for the Daily Express. There was a reporter for the Daily Express who got kidnapped by the Taliban. She got kidnapped by the Taliban and found she'd rather hang out with a load of Pushtun goat herds than with a load of Daily Express journalists in Fleet Street, and converted to Islam. The wife of the Boston bomber was a convert to Islam who grew up in small town New England, picket fence, cheerleader in high school, all American. And then at one point she comes home with a Muslim boyfriend and she says to her parents that she's going to convert to Islam. And of course, being nice New England liberals, they're all supportive of it and think it's just like an alternative lifestyle, like going vegan or whatever. So they're all supportive of her decision to become Muslim. And Douglas and I talk about this on the show, and I spoke to a lot of women who converted to Islam over in Europe, and they all tell basically some variant of the same story, that they were typical British or continental girls. You know, they'd go out on a Saturday night, They get completely rat-assed at the nightclub, go home with some bloke, wake up in the morning, he'd kick him out, and they do this for a few years, and they and one night they just, you know, wake up at 4 in the morning, lying in a pool of their own vomit on the sidewalk outside some sleazy club, and they realize that they wanted something more out of life, and that in fact what Denise says as security with freedom, that somehow the balance wasn't right for them. And they wanted something more. And they wanted, in a sense, a more structured existence than that total hedonistic bacchanal that we define as freedom in the West these days offered them. And I think particularly about that girl who was married to one of the Tsarnaev brothers, the Boston Marathon bombers. And the guy beat her up. You can beat up Muslim women, because the great thing about it is they wear a burqa, so nobody knows. You can beat them up to your heart's content, and then they go out black and blue and nobody sees it. Doesn't really matter. And in a sense, that's what the entire Western world has taken on, the condition of a battered woman, a battered wife with regard to Islam. And in a sense, we're all covering up too, where we slip the veil over our heads and we don't see what is going on around us. But I find it absolutely fascinating, this level of Muslim conversion among European women. If you look, for example, at the immigration statistics from refugees in Germany and Sweden, the countries that have let in the highest proportion of Muslim refugees, and they now have a China-like imbalance in the sex ratio, in the number of boys to girls among 16 and 17 year olds. And somebody asked me about that, said, what do you think that means? There's going to be all these guys who can't get any action. I said, no, I don't think it's going to be that way. I think what you'll find is that among that particular generational cohort, there will be an extraordinary conversion rate to Islam. I'll end up with one other thought on this too, which comes from visiting Rotherham, where 1,400 girls were supposedly groomed for sex slavery by, quote, Asian, unquote, gangs. Asian being the preferred euphemism for Muslim gangs, Muslim Pakistani gangs. It's a huge insult if you happen to be a Hindu or a Sinhalese from Sri Lanka, or a Buddhist from Thailand, or you happen to be from Hong Kong, or anywhere else in Asia. But in fact, it's Pakistani Muslim grooming gangs in Rotherham and elsewhere in England. And one thing you notice when you walk through the streets, they pick up these girls. These girls mostly come from broken homes. They're very vulnerable. And the Muslim guy, and I've heard similar stories in the Netherlands, the Muslim guys offer them a kind of security. You do what these guys say. The Muslim guys are also cooler. And I don't quite know how you quantify that. But you can see why, if you're just some Rotherham slattern, why you'd be more attracted to, like, the packy boy, as they call them, than to the native English boy. And that's particularly true when you get to Sweden. This is why I say the sex imbalance in Sweden. In Sweden, you're talking about these cool Muslim guys who the country has become flooded with, up against the sort of wispy-bearded, man-bunned Swedish males who seem kind of they seem barely there even when they're there. You see them pushing perambulators through the streets occasionally, carrying the shopping and everything, and you begin to understand why the sort of competing models of manhood, which is like your new male Scandinavian with the wispy beard and the man bun, or your big fat beery football bloke in Rotherham who's getting rat-assed at the pub, or the cool Muslim guy, you're beginning to see it's not difficult to figure out why there are actually such a high rate of Muslim conversion among women in the Western world. Drew Weber asks, please comment on denying birthright citizenship granted to illegal aliens. What they mean by that is the whole phenomenon of anchor babies, which Trump, everyone got annoyed with Trump using the term anchor babies. But people come here to the United States to give birth, because if you give birth, your child is an American citizen, and then you're the parent of an American citizen. So even if you had the child illegally, it's very hard to get rid of you. And very few countries have birthright citizenship. Those that do had in recent years, for one reason or another, managed to get rid of them. For example, Ireland used to have, I never had full birthright citizenship the same way that the United States does. But now you have to demonstrate, if you have a child in Ireland in an Irish hospital, that child is only Irish if one of its parents is Irish, is a citizen of Ireland or the United Kingdom. You can't just go and can't just come from Yemen and have a child in an Irish hospital and the child is Irish. And you can in America. And it makes no sense. It makes no sense in an age of mass travel. It makes no sense in an age when people are, you can take a flat bottom skiff across the Rio Grande. And it makes a mockery of citizenship. It makes an absolute mockery of citizenship. Australia is another place where you have to have a connection. The kid isn't an Australian just because he's born in an Australian hospital. You have to have an Australian parent. You have to have a connection to Australia. So I'm in favor of ending birthright citizenship. And people say, well, you know, the Supreme Court, who cares about the Supreme Court? There's prostration before judges, and the idea that judges are the supreme arbiters. I don't personally see the point of throwing off a king just to prostrate yourself before anybody who's wearing a black polyester robe. It seems a completely pointless kind of revolution. But the deference to judges' views on this, it seems to me entirely reasonable. If the state cannot define citizenship, then it is not a sovereign state. And naturalization is something that is in the gift of the existing citizens of that state. So somebody, and it doesn't matter whether it's Latin American peasants coming across the Rio Grande or Chinese people thinking they want to get out of jail free card in their pocket in case the powder keg goes up in China, who fly over and give birth in an American hospital. Either way, a sovereign state has the right to define who are its citizens. And saying in an age of mass transportation that anyone who gets simply makes it to the country and gives birth in a hospital is entitled to be a citizen is nuts. It's stupid. Progressive Western countries all over the developed world do not do it, and neither should the United States nor Canada, which actually isn't, doesn't have as insane a policy as the United States, but it's pretty bad. We have one of our Toronto members who says, when will you be announcing the club members write the caption t-shirt contest for the new line of Stein Store t-shirts? We've had complaints about our t-shirts, and it's true, we don't do a lot of t-shirt development in the t-shirt department at Mark Stein Enterprises. There's been some thought amongst club members that some famous lines of mine, you know, I don't know, like the one I have in America Alone, the future belongs to those who show up or whatever, that might make a good one to have on the exciting new range of Mark Stein baby diapers when you decide to do your bit to reverse that fertility rate. But some readers have said they'd like to have some of those famous lines of mine on T-shirts. And I tell you what, we'll make a deal. If you've got lines you'd like to see on T-shirts, drop us a line at Stein Online, and we will. What email should we use for this? Club at markstein.com, and we will. What we will do is we will take the 10 best, and we will put them on an exciting new line of T-shirts. And not just an exciting new line of T-shirts, but an exciting new line of T-shirts with exciting lines on them. How often do you see that? So that is what we are going to do. And just drop us a line to club@markstein.com. Also, let us know whether you like this particular live format. You know it's live because I'm doing time checks. It is coming up to 5 p.m. US Eastern Time. That is 10 p.m. in London, BST, British Summertime. 11 p.m. in Europe. And God knows what time on Wednesday morning in Vanuatu and the Cook Islands and the Solomon Islands and Tuvalu and other redoubts of the Pacific where we have Mark Stein Club members. But I thank you all for your questions. Let us know whether you like this format. If you don't, we'll do it some other way. But that wraps it up for this hour, and we will see you next time.